Kate moved for a better look, confirming it was indeed the cart used in a morgue to transfer corpses. This one had a plastic dome to keep the contents sealed. "Bring the subject in," Carr said, waving. Kate stood aside as the team pushed the cart toward the lab entrance. Carr led the procession inside. He peered around the room, a discerning scowl on his face, until he pointed to a corner.
"It's one ugly SOB," Beckham said.
The lab team filtered in and out of the room, bringing in boxes of supplies and equipment. Carr surveyed them, barking orders at the techs.
"Is he always like this?"
Kate said in a conspiratorial tone to Horn and Beckham.
"Definitely takes some getting used to," Beckham said.
Horn exhaled sharply.
"Guy like that probably likes the smells of his own farts. There's no getting used to that."
"That's just great," Kate said. "I hoped an extra hand around here would make this a little easier, but..."
"Well, you've got an entire team now," Beckham said.
The techs continued to unload equipment. The potential of their productivity had increased an order of magnitude, assuming cooperation with Carr wasn't difficult.
"The extra hands will help determine the office connection to the webbing faster," Kate nodded.
"Sooner we can figure out how it's working, the sooner we can shut it down," Beckham said.
"Dr. Lovato," Carr interrupted from the other side of the lab. "What's this monstrous thing growing in your cell culture room?" Beckham and Horn shot a glance at the aquarium.
"I was going to ask the same thing," Horn said. "Looks like what happens after I used to eat McDonald's."
"Very funny, Big Horn," Beckham groaned, shaking his head.
"That's the webbing," Kate said.
Beckham motioned for her to join him in the hallway. He jerked his chin at Horn, too, and they all retreated into the shadows. If Kate didn't know any better, she would say her husband appeared nervous.
"This better not be more bad news," Horn said.
Carr shot them a raised eyebrow, peering curiously at them as the team of techs continued flowing in and out of the lab with equipment. Beckham began in a hushed voice.
"Ringgold asked again about running for Macomb's seat."
"Brother, you're retired. Being a politician? Well, damn, that's the kind of stuff we told each other we'd never do,"
Horn responded gently.
"I know."
Beckham reached for Kate's hand.
"And I'm sorry. I am. I know we said we'd talk about it first, but with everything going on, we're inches from anarchy in this country, and inches from losing everything you and I and Team Ghost worked so hard to achieve. I can't stand by, sitting here on Peaks Island while everything crumbles."
Kate pulled her hand away.
"We're a team, Reed. There are people who need you here. Timothy, Beau, your son."
A grimace cut across Beckham's face.
"I haven't forgotten them, or you, or my friends. I'm just afraid that if we can't stabilize the political situation, things will only get worse for everyone."
Horn clapped a hand over Beckham's shoulder.
"You know I respect you, and look up to you, but I want it on record that I think this is the dumbest idea you've ever had."
"I have to run for Senate," Beckham firmly stated.
"You don't have to," Kate shot back. "We've got plenty to do around here."
"You've got plenty to do. You've got a whole team to help you in the lab now, and you've been plenty busy with experiments since the Raiders attack. I promise you won't even miss me while I'm campaigning."
"You know that's not true."
Kate looked away. Beckham leaned against the wall.
"I'm sorry, Kate, but if I don't run, who will?"
He looked at Horn.
"Clearly not Big Horn."
"Goddamn right," he said with a snort.
"You know politics can be just as dangerous as any mission with Team Ghost," Kate suddenly responded. "Ringgold has enemies. Look at what happened to Senator Macomb."
"She's right," Horn said. "With people angry as they are, who's to say another crazy ROT group shows up and tries to take you down?"
"Or maybe they already have," Kate said, thinking of the Raiders.
"My goal in running is to ensure that doesn't happen," Beckham said.
"Still think this is the wrong move."
Horn kicked his toe against the tiled floor.
"But damn it, you're Reed Beckham, and you haven't got us killed yet, so I guess I gotta support you."
Beckham offered him a measured grin and looked to Kate.
"You know I support you too, whatever you do," she said. "But that doesn't mean I like it."
"I'll take that for now."
He held her hand again, and this time she let him.
I'm sorry I basically agreed to this before talking to you first, but...
We can talk later. I better get back to the lab.
Kate glanced over her shoulder.
I don't trust Carr in there.
One last thing. Beckham pulled her back. Ringgold wants me at a rally with her tomorrow, which means I've got to leave first thing in the morning, he said.
Kate sighed and shook her head.
I'll see you at the shelter when I get off work.
I'm sorry, Kate, Beckham said.
Me too, but what can we do?
With that, Beckham and Horn left the corridor, and she returned to her office. The techs had a nearly complete autopsy suite ready. Atop the table lay the abomination still covered by the plastic dome. The beast underneath did not disappoint her expectations. The ape-like face with bat-like ears were even more gruesome than she had imagined. Long spines stuck out from under the back. They appeared both delicate and dangerous, not unlike a stack of fencing sabers.
Carr stepped up next to her.
It's a beauty, right?
Sure is, Kate said. Got any idea how it interacts with that webbing yet?
I have a few ideas.
Let's get to work then.
Carr hesitated, suddenly not as ambitious as he was when he got here. Perhaps he had heard some of her conversation with Beckham and wondered if she was up to the task.
Sure you don't need a break? Carr asked. You seem a little tense. I don't want it to hamper our work.
Nothing hampers my work.
Kate tossed a set of goggles to him and put some on herself.
Well, do not let me hold us back then, Carr said.
Please, lead on, Dr. Lovato.
Gather round, boys, Fisher yelled. He stoked the sides of his freshly trimmed mustache as his security guards and hired hunters approached. Over 50 men dressed in camouflaged fatigues with automatic weapons and high-powered hunting rifles stood on his property this morning. Another group had just parked in a gravel lot full of pickup trucks and dust-covered SUVs. Every security guard on the Fisher Fields payroll was here tonight, plus the hired help they had brought in to hunt. There were also the 10 soldiers President Ringgold had sent to help secure the oil fields. The men had arrived yesterday in a pair of rusting Humvees, led by a man named Sergeant Ken Sharp. He and his boys had seen plenty of action, and Sharp was a native Texan, which Fisher appreciated. But just 10 men and some shitty equipment that looked like it had come from an army surplus store? It just reaffirmed the fact her administration wasn't serious about protecting his fields. And if the government wasn't going to take care of the variants in the area, he was going to do it the way they used to in the Wild West, with blood and bullets. Word had spread fast across the Allied states, and the men were all talking about what was going on, raiders and mysterious variant tunnels popping up across the Midwest. Texas was a long way from the heart of the trouble, but everyone here knew it was just a matter of time before the variants and their human collaborators hit the Lone Star State. Fisher had no doubt the increased variant activity was a sign of a growing threat, something more dangerous than anyone in the government was letting on. While he wasn't sure what sinister alpha or alphas were behind it, he wasn't going to stand idly by and wait for their attack. There was one old adage that had always proven true in matters of personal and business interest. The best defense was a good offense. Dealing with variants was no exception. His most trusted soldiers, Tran and Chase, agreed with his decision to hunt the diseased monsters on his property. Now it was time to break it to everyone else.
That's the last of them, said Tran.
Chase swept his gaze over the crowd from under the bill of his Fisher Fields baseball cap. The two lead security agents flanked Fisher on the deck overlooking his backyard where the men had gathered. Blazing sunlight bore down on the hardened faces of men that in some cases had been fighting the monsters for 8 years or more now. Fisher may have been standing over them, but he felt like he was one of them. He instinctively put his hands on his chrome belt buckle holding up his fatigues and filled his lungs with the dry breeze.
As many of you have heard, the Allied States is under attack, Fisher bellowed. The variants are going after the outposts, taking those homesteaders underground into God only knows what kind of hell on earth.
The men all seemed to stiffen, their gazes locked on Fisher.
Several outposts in the east got hit by raiders that some suspect might be human collaborators, he continued. With human enemies and the monsters fighting on all fronts, I'm afraid we can't count on someone over 1,500 miles away to save us.
Hushed conversations broke out in the crowd, but the 10 soldiers present remained quiet, not reacting to his words at all.
"That's why we're all here," Fisher said. "I've got my own backup plans."
He looked at part of those plans in the distance. Multiple industrial barns that housed his cattle sat in rows about a quarter mile away on the eastern edge of his property. Electrical fences surrounded the metal buildings. The only way in was a gate guarded by two men at all times. More guards patrolled the inside. They were there now, walking with their shotguns and rifles. The expensive redundancy had protected his livestock for years now, and it had worked for his oil derricks until recently.
"We're going to Plan B today," Fisher said. "We're not waiting for the variants to come to us anymore. Instead, we'll find the holes they're hiding in and..."
Fisher reached for a bag Chase held and pulled out a stick of TNT.
"We will blow the dirty bastards out of their nests like the varmints they are."
Several of the men in the crowd grunted their approval, but they weren't all convinced. A former sheriff's deputy that now worked for Fisher spat a blob of tobacco on the dirt and said,
"How do we know where the devils sleep?"
"Our friends here helped with some of that," Fisher said, gesturing to the army soldiers. "I also paid good money for a private tracking team to dig up my own intel."
He nodded in the direction of two men in the crowd. The older guy, a man named Aaron Galinsky, had short-cropped hair and was former Israeli military. His partner, Eric Welling, had hair to his shoulders and looked as if he had stepped straight out of the Australian outback.
"I got a pretty good idea where the demons sleep," Fisher said. "And if we have our way, they're never waking up."
"You're asking us to put our lives on the line," said another man. "What's in it for us?"
"I will be paying very well," Fisher replied. "Every man that goes out with us will receive triple hazard pay. Bonuses will go to anyone that kills a variant. Bag an alpha, and you get $5,000.
"But what are we waiting for? Let's get out there," yelled Galinsky.
Welling laughed, and several men in the crowd joined in. Fisher smiled at the change in enthusiasm. If there was one thing that could change a man's heart real fast, it was a wheelbarrow full of cash.
"You all trained for this," Fisher said. "Gonna be like shooting fish in a barrel."
He nodded at Tran and Chase, who both dispersed into the crowd to hand out maps and assignments. An hour later, the 60-plus group had split into 6 teams of 10. They loaded up into their pickup trucks and SUVs with their weapons slung and spirits high. 3 of the teams would head 30 miles to the hills in the southwest, and the other 3 would head with Fisher to the hills in the southeast. All signs pointed to those areas being potential nest locations, from tracks to the direction of most attacks. Fisher got into his pickup truck, riding shotgun with Chase behind the wheel. Tran hopped in the back of the dual cab with Sergeant Sharp, and soon as the door shut, they were off. The convoy took the road past the barns of cattle, chickens, and pigs on the way out. Fisher Fields provided almost 5% of the nation's meat, something else he was damn proud of. But that was a small contribution compared to how much oil he was producing for the country. As of now, his fields were supplying over 25% of the nation's refined petroleum products. The fact he couldn't get more government help in protecting them was maddening. It was also the reason he was leaning toward supporting General Cornelius in the general election. Chase raised a hand out the window to several guards patrolling the interior of the electric fences as they passed the barns.
"How many men did you pull off sentry duty?" Fisher asked.
"Half, but don't worry, there are still plenty," Chase said.
Fisher looked at the blazing sun. The variants were far more likely to attack when the sun had sunk beyond the horizon, just about now. But he still worried about leaving so few men to guard his livestock. He tried to relax on the ride to the foothills. The beauty of the open fields and blue skies helped. The ride took them through the flat country, past several of the oil derricks, where more of his workers monitored the extraction and others guarded the precious resource. Fisher pulled out his map and then put on his reading glasses. He studied the potential nesting areas for a few moments before turning to Sharp.
"Sergeant, which site do you think is most likely to be an active nest?" he asked.
Sharp seemed to tense at the question, which gave Fisher his answer. The army soldiers had no idea.
"Hard to say," Sharp replied, hoping to sound confident.
"Did you or did you not confirm the presence of variants at these locations?"
"We did,"
Sharp said,
"but we did not confirm numbers."
In other words, you didn't get close enough.
Sharp said nothing. Fisher turned back to the front seat, suddenly questioning how useful these maps would be. The other teams were heading to the location marked by Welling and Galinsky. Now he wondered if he should head to the location the two professional trackers were going.
So, we don't know if any of these are live tunnels, Fisher asked.
We confirmed the presence of bones just outside several, Sharp replied. However, since we didn't get close, we couldn't see how fresh the kills were. It's always hard to say with bones anyway because the variants don't leave much behind.
Fisher gave the sergeant that. The beasts stripped everything clean. The best way to tell if a tunnel or hole was active was their feces. Dust billowed up ahead as the convoy of vehicles hit a gravel road. Chase eased off the gas to give them some room. The next road was paved and took them past several more derricks. Over the next hill, they got their first view of their target.
Here we go, Chase said.
He followed the other vehicles to a staging area off the road where he parked next to one of the Army Humvees. Fisher jumped out and went to the back bed of the truck to pull out his M4A1. Tran grabbed his SR-25, and Chase slung his carbine. Sergeant Sharp spoke to his men while they charged their weapons. In total, 30 men gathered outside the vehicles, including the 10 soldiers. Sharp told a corporal and PFC to take point, and they set off toward the clumps of hills a quarter mile away, fanning out into the grass. Tran and Chase remained close to Fisher, but let him lead the way. He kept behind Sharp, eyeing the foothills. The mounds of brown earth were covered in vegetation and trees, unlike a lot of the surrounding area. Plenty of places for variants to hide. The soldiers fanned out ahead into two teams, weapons up and roving. Fisher followed his team across the field, heart thumping with excitement. Being out here with these men made him nostalgic for the hunts he had gone on as a kid. Only this hunt was far more dangerous than going after wild boars. The two groups peeled off, filing down separate tracks. Fisher kept behind Sharp. Underbrush scraped across his fatigues, and his boots crunched over small rocks. Fisher spotted the first evidence of variant tracks in the dirt ahead. Sharp pointed them out, but then continued on up a hill and through the spindly vegetation. Skeletal limbs from dead trees reached out like grasping fingers. Most of the vegetation on the other side of the hill was dry and brown. The lack of leaves and underbrush made the tunnels easier to spot. Sharp stopped to look at his map, and then pointed to the next hill on their right. The group peeled off into two smaller teams and moved toward the holes. Fisher was one of the first to reach it, and stopped about 10 feet away. He aimed his barrel at the entrance of the shadowed cavern. Sure enough, several animal bones were scattered just inside the lip of the dirt hole. He bent down with Sharp, and they directed their lights inside, revealing more bones scattered on the dirt floor. Raking his light, Fisher saw no signs of fresh variant feces.
"This must be an old one," Fisher said.
Sharp gestured toward the group that had veered off to check another cavern. Two of his soldiers had crouched down in front of it for a better look. By the time Fisher got there, they had ducked inside. The rest of the group waited outside, weapons angled at the entrance. A radio crackled, and Tran pulled it out from his pouch.
FF1, this is FF2, do you copy? Came a voice.
Fisher waited anxiously for the report from his team at the other location.
Copy FF2, this is FF1, what you got? Tran replied.
Nothing, FF1, we've got dead tunnels. You have better luck than us?
Stand by, FF2, Tran said.
He put the radio back in his pouch and moved over with Fisher to get a better look inside the tunnel. The soldiers were already returning, and they were carrying something. Fisher didn't need his flashlight to see one of the items was a helmet with the FF logo. The men crawled out of the hole with gear and several bones of the final missing derrick engineer.
"Looks like an old nest," said the soldier.
He looked down at the helmet.
"At least we found his remains."
Fisher nodded, happy that the family would have some closure now. But disappointed he wasn't going to get to use any of his TNT. He spat on the ground and turned his back to look at the dead terrain.
"Where the hell did you bastards go?"
Fisher muttered.
15.
Beckham hated getting dressed up almost as much as Horn did, but today he found himself in a sharp navy blue suit with a red tie. Suits were for businessmen and politicians, he had been told as a young man.
You're going to be a politician, he thought. You're going to have to get used to this.
He wasn't the only one that didn't like what he was wearing. President Ringgold had complained about the bulletproof vest Beckham had insisted she wore today. She sat in a chair next to the vice president for an interview with a reporter across the lobby in a hotel in Outpost New Boston, not far from the site of the raider attack. The president had insisted on moving the rally here. Ringgold was probably telling the reporter the same thing she had said to Beckham. I will not be intimidated, she had said. I will not be scared off by these cowards. Beckham waited by a window near the hotel's entrance. Outside, hundreds had gathered in the street. Most held New America Coalition signs, but not everyone seemed so enthusiastic. He scanned the faces with his normal paranoid mindset. Any of them could be enemies, raiders and collaborators. The assholes had penetrated several outposts, including this one, and he feared they would try again. Beckham let the drape fall over the window and made his way back into the lobby. President Ringgold and Vice President Lemke were still talking to a female reporter from the New Boston Globe paper. The Globe was one of several institutions of journalism that had made a comeback over the past few years. With television and civilian cell phone service still a thing of the past, printed news was one of the only ways for average citizens to get their information, which made this interview very important. He waited patiently for it to conclude, and then walked over. There you are, Captain, Ringgold said. I've got to talk to you. Beckham stepped over. The middle-aged reporter seemed to measure him up with a sweeping gaze before she finally walked away with her bag. Ringgold got out of her chair and motioned for Lemke and Beckham to follow her to a conference room off the lobby. Two Secret Service agents shadowed them to the door where they stood sentry. Close that, please, Ringgold said. Beckham closed the door, anticipating more bad news. Team Ghost reported in late last night, Lemke said. They think they know the epicenter of the variant activity. Minneapolis, Minnesota, Ringgold said.
Really? Beckham said. That's a heck of a long ways away from some of the outposts the variants attacked.
He paused to think a moment, and then said, What does SOCOM think about this? Honestly, we're not sure yet, but we're going to find out, Lemke said. Operation Shadow is continuing with the deployment of 6 teams, including Team Ghost, to figure out what we're dealing with, Ringgold said. All the teams so far have reported similar findings around the attacked outposts. Variants used tunnels to get under the defenses. When our teams followed the tunnels out, they eventually disappeared, and they were left only with the remnants of webbing to follow, Lemke added. Now we're sending Team Ghost to Minneapolis and the other teams to 5 other targets where the webbing seems to lead, Ringgold continued. Lemke handed Beckham a folder. Inside were the names of the targets. Minneapolis, Minnesota, Chicago, Illinois, Lincoln, Nebraska, Kansas City, Missouri, Indianapolis, Indiana, and Columbus, Ohio. These are the other likely locations of the civilians abducted from outposts, Lemke said. If these people were taken to any of these locations, there could be hundreds of others under these cities. The teams are heading out shortly, and I wanted you to know, Ringgold said. But I won't be mentioning this to anyone out there. For now, the mission stays under wraps. I don't want there to be any chance of it leaking to collaborators. The suggestion made Beckham tense up even more. In the past, rival campaigns might have sent spies to listen to speeches. Now they had to worry about traitorous human collaborators working with the variants. I'm just waiting for a leak to happen, though, Ringgold said. I'm sure Cornelius will find out, and push even more for nuking these sites regardless of the potential innocent lives we could lose.
Nuking the city might not even destroy the nests anyway, Beckham added. The creatures are resilient, more so than cockroaches. I wouldn't be surprised if those tunnels go pretty deep under the cities.
Precisely, Ringgold agreed. And, of course, most people supporting Cornelius's Freedom Party agenda don't realize this. I've also been trying to bring more attention to how many people are still scratching out a living outside of the outposts in cities like Minneapolis, Lemke said.
Yeah, but Cornelius does not care about them, Beckham said. In his eyes and the eyes of his supporters, the people outside the outposts have made their choice. They're nothing but collateral damage.
Or human collaborators, Lemke said. That's their new line. Anyone behind the lines are working with the variants.
Bullfucking shit. Beckham winced a second later. Sorry for my language.
It's quite all right, Ringgold said with a grin.
Hopefully you mentioned this stuff in your interview with the Globe, Beckham subtly inquired. Lemke nodded and looked to Ringgold.
Actually, that's what I want to talk to you about, she said, pausing for a moment. I'm hoping you'll talk today, not just to the crowd, but to the reporters. You're a national hero, Lemke said.
Now Beckham knew why the reporter had studied him like that. She was sizing him up for a potential interview. All due respect, but I'm not good at talking to crowds, and I've never liked journalists, Beckham said. No offense to the profession, but as a soldier, I'm used to saying less than more.
Ringgold sighed and looked at Lemke. Beckham hated the fact his past could be used for the election, but he knew it was necessary to save lives, especially if it could stop the cities from being nuked.
Look at page 5 of your briefing folder, Lemke said.
Beckham flipped to recent poll numbers. The tide has changed, Ringgold began tapping her foot unconsciously. Citizens are blaming us for what's happening at the outposts.
She stepped forward and put a hand on his shoulder.
I know what you might be thinking, but you're not a political pawn. You are a patriot, and your country needs you and your wife again.
And we will serve until our last breaths, Beckham said.
I know, Ringgold said with a kind smile. We better get out there.
Thank you, Captain, Lemke said.
Beckham hesitated before following the President and Vice President back to the lobby, his mind racing. By the time he joined them, James Soprano and Elizabeth Cortez had arrived.
Ready?
Cortez asked cheerfully.
Always, Ringgold said with a smile.
Soprano handed the president her speech, and they set off with a team of Secret Service agents. They moved in a cordon around the POTUS and V-POTUS as soon as they were outside, joining more agents posted on the sidewalk. Brick and stone buildings framed the historic street where they would give their speech and ask these people for their support. Beckham spotted snipers posted on rooftops and knew there were even more he couldn't see behind darkened windows. The military was also here, with an entire Marine platoon on this block alone. Security was tight, and everyone that had come to see the two speak had gone through metal detectors. But there were other ways in, and more weapons than guns. He fiddled with the buttons on his suit, cursed under his breath, and told himself to relax as he followed the leaders of the country. Talking in front of people scared him more than facing a variant. Coupled with his nerves about threats in the crowd, he was practically sweating bullets. Elizabeth Cortez took the stage first, heading to the podium that sported the New America Coalition logo. She tapped the microphone. Static broke from the speakers. The crowd quieted.
Good afternoon, and thank you for coming out today, Cortez said. President Jan Ringgold and Vice President Dan Lemke are here to talk about everything the administration has achieved and hopes to achieve with another 4 years of the New America Coalition.
Beckham sensed the tension in the woman's normally peppy voice. He didn't blame her. Only about half of the crowd responded positively with claps and applause. Cortez smiled after a pause and said,
"But you didn't come here to see me, so without further ado, I'm honored to present President Jan Ringgold."
Beckham clapped and was relieved that most everyone joined in. He watched the president walk up to the stage and step up to the podium.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for taking the time to be a part of our movement, Ringgold said.
She set her speech out on the podium and looked over the crowd.
Today I'm outlining a vision for our future, a vision that builds on our history of achievements and victories, a vision that includes all of you, she said. I know many of you are scared. You've heard about the recent attacks, and you might be wondering, how can I stand up here and talk about achievements during these trying times?
Damn right, someone shouted.
Ringgold recognized the man with a nod.
I understand being scared and being mad. I have done everything in my power to protect our country and will continue to do so in the face of evil.
another man yelled out in the distance.
You failed us!
The crowd broke out in a storm of voices. Ringgold waited for them to quiet down.
Please, she urged, give me a few minutes of your time, and when I finish, I will stick around to personally answer your questions.
The citizens seemed to calm down, and she continued after a brief pause.
The variant threat is still out there. We believe they are planning something. But at this point, I don't believe in destroying our cities and killing the people living there or killing the people the variants have captured.
Nuke the cities!
Someone yelled. Another shouted, We have to do it!
No, we don't, Ringgold said. In a few moments, we're going to introduce you to someone that will explain why we don't and why doing so will cause far more harm than good.
Beckham knew she was looking in his direction, but he was looking at two men dressed in dark brown jackets. One had a scruffy beard, and the other had a face marred by a long scar. Their emotionless features stood out to him. Neither of them seemed to be reacting to Ringgold's speech in a positive or negative manner. Their faces remained stern, even when others exploded in enthusiastic cheers or angry jeers. Beckham relocated down the sidewalk for a better look, keeping his hand low, near the Sig Sauer he had holstered under his suit jacket. For the next few minutes, he drowned out Ringgold's speech and focused his senses on the crowd. Vice President Lemke joined President Ringgold on stage, wearing a dimpled smile. The two onlookers still remained stern-faced. Becca moved again, and was able to see they wore muddy boots and pants with rips in the side. Suspicious, but not all that much different than what a lot of people were wearing. Lemke went into his speech, talking about his new proposals to spur the safe zone economies and reignite global trade, but Beckham was hardly listening. He started off into the crowd, carefully maneuvering around families that had come out to see the president and vice president. Several people holding New America Coalition signs moved and blocked his view of the two suspicious men. Beckham made his way around the campaign signs and then paused, just as the two men spotted him. The one with the beard jerked his chin to the other, and they promptly turned and began their way out. The crowd cheered at Lemke's speech as Beckham moved faster. By the time he got to the sidewalk across the street, the two men were practically jogging.
I promise our brave men and women will identify and destroy this new variant threat, Lemke said to the roar of the crowd.
Beckham flagged down two Secret Service agents and pointed at the two men. Using his radio, one of the agents called in reinforcements to stop the men before they could escape. The crowd quieted behind them.
Now I'd like to introduce you to another brave man that has fought for our country against overwhelming odds since day one of the variant threat, Lemke said.
Beckham paused as two Secret Service agents and a pair of Marines rounded a corner at the end of the block and told the two fleeing men to stop. The bearded guy reached inside his coat pocket and pulled out a plastic canister the size of a water bottle. The other guy took off running.
Drop it!
Shouted a soldier, aiming his rifle. The other soldier pursued the runner with a Secret Service agent around the next corner. People at the rear of the crowd turned to look, but Lemke was still speaking, his voice booming. Most of the people at the front and middle still hadn't noticed what was happening.
It's my honor to present Medal of Honor recipient Captain Reed Beckham, he said. Please join me in welcoming this hero today.
Beckham took off in the opposite direction of the stage.
Captain Reed Beckham, Lemke said again.
Murmurs flowed through the crowd, but Beckham wasn't listening. He watched in horror as the bearded man tossed the contents of his canister at the soldier. Fluid hit him in the face and he cried out in agony, dropping to his knees. Gunshots followed as the Secret Service agent took down the assailant with multiple rounds. Beckham drew his weapon. Screams rang out in all directions, and Beckham glanced over his shoulder as the president and vice president were whisked off the stage by security. Seeing they were safe, he continued toward the violence, navigating through the crowd until he reached the downed soldier. The man twitched on his back, his sizzling features erased by variant acid. Next to him, the body of the collaborator lay in a pool of blood, his eyes roving. They flitted to Beckham as he approached. The dying man gasped for his last breaths through black teeth.
Adios, Reed, he said.
Then he was gone, his eyes rolling up and his chest flattening.
16.
The C-27J Spartan shook as the plane entered another patch of rough turbulence. Fitz held on to the cable above his head, bracing himself. The sounds of groaning and flexing metal resonated through the cabin along with the throaty drone of the engines. Fitz looked around at the rest of Team Ghost as they finished putting on the rub that would hopefully mask their scent from the variants. Mendez closed his eyes. His lips moved in silent prayer. Doha's jaw was set and expression stern, almost as if he were a marble statue. Rico popped another bubble, and Ace and Lincoln checked their weapons. Fitz could feel the electricity of tension in the air. Soon they would be jumping out of the back of the Spartan 17,000 feet above Minneapolis in the dead of night. The mission would leave them alone for several days and nights behind enemy territory. This wasn't Fitz's first rodeo, but he couldn't help but feel this mission was more dangerous and different than all the others.
5 minutes until drop, the crew chief reported, standing near the rear door.
A tether hooked to his harness kept him attached to a metal loop on the bulkhead.
All right, y'all, Fitz said, looking at each member seated around him. Call signs are the usual. I'm Ghost 1 and Alpha Team Leader with Ace and Lincoln. They're Ghost 4 and 5. Ace is our designated R2TD operator. Rico, your Ghost 2 and Bravo Leader with Dohai and Mendez. They're 6 and 3, respectively.
The team responded with a chorus of grunts and nods.
This is a halo jump, Fitz continued. So we won't be pulling chutes until 3,000 feet. There's no telling what's down there. Stealth will be key to avoiding detection. Keep your wits about you and stay low.
He looked at Rico with those last words, and she nodded, giving him a wink. Just enough to let him know she understood what had gone unspoken between them. Be careful. The aircraft bucked again.
If we encounter civilians, we mark their location and move on, Fitz said. Our goal is to extract intel, not people. What if we find a shit ton?
Lincoln questioned with raised eyebrows.
You mark it, dummy, Ace responded.
Pendejo, Mendez said.
Fitz had since learned that roughly translated to dumbass or idiot. He'd had about enough of Ace and Mendez's bantering.
Cut the shit already, Fitz snapped.
He's right, Rico said. You guys need to quit the jokes and focus. Fitz waited a moment before continuing. Now that he had their full attention, he said,
Our DZ is a softball field. Rally point is 100 yards east, place called Bohemian Flats Park. If you land outside the DZ, head straight to the rally point.
The team nodded in response.
Our two main targets are the University of Minnesota and downtown Minneapolis, he added. Satellite imagery confirms some recent variant activity in both locations, so maintain radio silence on the surface unless it's an absolute emergency. Approaching target, the crew chief said. Oxygen on.
Rico spit out her gum into her palm and slapped it on her helmet. She hesitated before putting her oxygen mask on to look at Fitz.
Stay safe, Fitzy, she said.
I love you, Fitz mouthed in reply.
Her dimples widened.
I love you, too.
Cute shit, Ace yelled.
Rico rolled her eyes and strapped her oxygen mask over her face. Fitz did the same thing and secured his visor.
Door open, the crew chief said as he hit the mechanism to open the rear door.
Air blasted in, wind slamming the team. Fitz could barely hear anything over the roar filling the troop hold. With a hand signal, the crew chief gestured for them to approach the rear door. Fitz waddled toward him. The weight of all his gear for this multi-day mission and the heavy MC-5 parachute strapped to his back dragged him down. Ace had it the worst with the R2TD system over the front of his chest, plus his shotgun and suppressed M4A1. Dohai was first in line with his fingers wrapped tightly around the harnesses strapped over his chest. The crew chief held his arm bent at the elbow and then made a chopping motion.
Go time, Fitz thought.
Dohai stepped out first and immediately disappeared in the blackness. Next went Ace, then Lincoln. Rico followed with Mendez, leaving just Fitz on the platform. He paused there briefly. Beneath the scattered clouds lay a carpet of black. No lights punctuated the city, no fires, no signs of life at all. Even with the assistance of his night vision goggles, he saw only dark except for the blinking strobes of his team's IR tags far below.
The crew chief motioned for Fitz to drop, and he moved over the edge into freefall. For the first few minutes, he felt nothing but the weight of his pack and gear. Then the wind took him, pulling, tugging, and slamming his body like an angry ghost. He fought back, battling the forces lashing his body until he brought his arms tight against his sides. Maneuvering into a nosedive, he rocketed toward terminal velocity. The adrenaline chugging through his body seemed to lessen, and instinct took over. This was the part of jumps he could normally enjoy, the feeling of weightlessness and freedom. But there was no joy to be found in a dive like this, knowing what they were headed toward tonight. Craning his visor, he saw the last two blinking IR tags showing Rico and Lincoln catching up to him. The Spartan continued onward, abandoning them to gravity and the variants. The IR tags below started to coalesce, just as they were trained. After another couple thousand feet, Fitz made it over to Dohai, Ace, and Lincoln, who were already into stable arch positions to slow their fall. Not long after, Rico and Mendez found them, breaking out of their nosedives and into arch position too. For now, the team moved into formation, bodies spread out, arms and legs bent enough to guide them through the air. If all went well, and the stars aligned, the variants would never know they were even here. Fitz shifted his wrist enough to see his altimeter watch. Just a few thousand more feet to go before they deployed their chutes. The navigation aid, NavAid, showed they were still on target. Low opening freefalls like this were not forgiving when it came to mistakes, and once they hit an altitude of 3,000 feet, there was precious little time between deploying their chutes and landing without busting their bones, especially with the weight of all their equipment. Fitz watched the numbers shoot down on his watch. They were seconds from deployment. He motioned for the team to spread back out. The team gracefully fanned apart, giving each other ample room to deploy their chutes without tangling their lines or colliding. When Fitz was comfortable with their distance, he reached up and yanked on his cord. His chute exploded open behind him, pulling hard on his body. The harnesses tightened around his shoulders like a giant hand from the back. The dark chutes of the other Team Ghost members bloomed around him one by one. All except Mendez. His chute came out like a snake, twisting around wildly. Somewhere, somehow, something had gotten tangled just enough that the chute couldn't fully deploy. Mendez whipped around like he was trapped in a cyclone. Fitz adjusted his chute, positioning himself closer to Mendez's position, but the other soldier was being pulled away wildly.
"Can't get control!"
Mendez yelled over their channel.
"Cut to reserve!" Fitz shouted back.
Mendez reached to release his chute, but thanks to the malfunction of his first chute, he'd been tossed far from the landing site showing on Fitz's NavAid. An enemy world of whites and greens came into view. The concrete jungle rose up to meet their boots, growing nearer by the second. Fitz was close enough to see highways littered with charred vehicles and skeletal buildings blown to pieces from the failed Operation Liberty. Fitz's heart climbed into his throat. If Mendez's reserve chute didn't pull soon, he would end up smeared across the concrete.
"Deploy!"
Fitz cried. The reserve chute shot out of Mendez's pack in the distance. He was far from the Mississippi River now, pushed off course and headed past the snaking 35 West Interstate toward downtown. Fitz breathed a sigh of relief, but his relief was short-lived.
"Mother of Jesus," Mendez said. "I've got hostiles across my LZ."
Fitz glanced at the NavAid. The rest of the team was still on their way to the DZ near Bohemian Flats. They would land in the open fields and make their way to the park on the river, giving them plenty of open space to cut loose and leave their chutes. But Mendez was headed right in the middle of the urban hell. The ground was approaching quickly, and there was no way for Fitz to make up enough distance now to reunite with Mendez.
"Ghost 3, I want you to get as close as you can to Gold Medal Park. It's a mile west of our DZ," Fitz said. "Post up there if the streets aren't safe."
"Copy," Mendez said.
His chute disappeared behind a screen of buildings framing the highway. The tattered grass of the old softball fields spread before Fitz. He eyed the landing zone and prepared to do a two-stage flare. Seconds later, his blades hit the ground and he ran out the momentum, all the while looking for movement in the field. His chute floated down behind him as he ran forward and slowed. Coming to a stop, he quickly shed his harness and chute. Around him,
Team Ghost completed their descents, chutes falling to the ground like deflating balloons sucked to the grass. Fitz crouched down, raising his rifle, while his team shed their harnesses and chutes. The team collected their jump gear, and Fitz looked for a place to stow it. He thought the base of a tree at the field edge would work, but something in the back of his mind told him to hold off. Wishing they had time to bury the gear properly, Fitz gave the signal to move out to the Bohemian Flats Park. A wall of trees lined the perimeter of the park, except where a pedestrian path stretched across the river toward the university campus. All the vegetation seemed sapped of life, dry and brown. Even the overgrown grass had died off, crunching beneath their feet. A mobile construction office trailer sat at the near edge of the park beside the pedestrian path. Its door hung open, and the windows were all broken. It wasn't perfect, but it would do as a storage spot for their jump gear. And once inside, he could break radio silence to check on Mendez. Turning, Fitz scanned the shadows in the forested area. Nothing moved in the darkness. He checked the rest of his team as they finished stowing their gear. Their discarded chutes caught the wind rustling through the grass, flapping and creating a muffled scratching sound. But that wasn't the only thing Fitz heard. Distant groans and clicks echoed over the park. Somewhere out there, the variants were on the prowl. Beyond the trees, a beast suddenly screamed, freezing Fitz in place. Scanning the pines, Fitz knew the monsters were close, and he wondered if they had heard the chutes snapping open at such a low altitude. Fitz signaled them to form up on him, then gestured for Dohai and Ace to take point and head for the construction trailer. Team Ghost moved out, rifles coming up quickly, probing the darkness. Their advance wasn't easy with the extra bulk of the Halo gear. They walked with clumsy gaits trying to manage it all toward the construction trailer. None of this stuff was supposed to be carried once they had hit the ground. Ace pushed the door open, cleared the space, and then gestured for the team to go inside. Once everyone was in, Lincoln shut the door, and the team stowed their chutes and oxygen supplies under the desks in there. Fitz directed the rest of the team to watch out the windows for hostiles. He hated to make any sound, even inside, but he had to know if Mendez was alive.
Ghost 3, Ghost 1, do you copy? He whispered into his mic. Static filled his earpiece. Ghost 3, Ghost 1, do you copy? Over.
The channel remained silent. Fitz pictured the variants ripping Mendez to pieces. The imagery filled him with dread. He could do nothing to help his teammate.
Ghost 3, I say again, do you copy? Fitz whispered a final time.
The only response he got was the wind rushing through the blinds of the office trailer and the constant noise of the distant variants. Dohai and Lincoln glanced at Fitz. Rico signaled to him that she had eyes on a hostile, and it was headed into the open fields. The comm channel suddenly fired with a voice.
Ghost 1, Ghost 3, I'm holed up, but I think they got my scent, Mendez whispered back.
Location? Fitz asked.
Inside a condo at the corner of 11th and South Washington.
Can you make it to Gold Medal Park?
Negative. At least not yet. Soon as I set foot outside this place, I'm toast.
Keep your head down. We'll come to you.
Rico pointed to the tree line. Fitz heard the clicking of joints and looked out the window as variants emerged from the darkness. The pack prowled on all fours, their tongues lashing against their sucker lips. A brute led them down the slope toward the fence along the river. Team Ghost was being surrounded, just like Mendez. Dread welled up inside his gut as Fitz considered their next move. They would have to split off in order to save Mendez, and that meant sending Rico off with Dohai. Fitz cursed his anger, but managed to separate his feelings like all the other times they had run into issues like this.
Rico, he whispered, after we get out of here, I want you and Dohai to go after Mendez, then sweep downtown, find any signs of the tunnel origins and the webbing.
He turned to Ace and Lincoln next.
We're going straight to the university, but first we take down this pack, Fitz said.
The variants swept the area, changing direction as they approached the trailer, while another pack emerged at the edges of the park. They were closing in. The leading monster skittered over toward the mobile office, stopping about 100 yards away to sniff the air. Its bony back went rigid like an angry cat,
confirming it had picked up their scent. It let out a screech that sent the other beasts into a frenzy. The creatures bolted toward the trailer. If Team Ghost fired now, they might be able to hold them off for a little while, but more would be drawn to their location. An idea simmered in Fitz's mind. He grabbed an oxygen tank from their halo equipment and moved toward one of the broken open windows. He heaved the football-sized tank as far as he could. It sailed silently over the heads of the variants before thudding into the ground. The noise drew their attention, and several creatures galloped over. Taking a breath, Fitz raised his rifle and moved his finger over the trigger.
"Everyone down," he whispered.
The team crouched, and Fitz fired. A round flew from the suppressed barrel and hit home, puncturing the oxygen tank and sparking against its shell. The spark was enough to ignite it, and the tank ruptured, exploding. A low boom echoed over the park. The fireball bloomed overhead. Flames rolled over the bodies of the variants, burning away their flesh.
"Open fire," Fitz said.
Team Ghost angled their suppressed rifles out the window, and they slaughtered the rest of the beasts. As the last of the variants hit the ground, Fitz motioned for the team to abandon their shelter.
"All it takes is all you got," Fitz said. "Good luck, Bravo team."
"Good luck,"
Rico responded back. Fitz suddenly experienced the same dread that came on every mission where they had to split up. Watching her venture out into enemy territory without him now was one of the hardest things he'd had to do on any mission. While her skills in the field were unrivaled by most soldiers, all it took was one mistake, one errant variant claw. And that was it. All he could do was hope for the best and trust she would make it back alive.
"Let's move," Lincoln said.
Fitz nodded and set off with Ace and Lincoln in the opposite direction of Rico and Dohai. It wasn't ideal, but it would hopefully save Mendez's life. An old military adage surfaced in his mind as Fitz ran on his carbon fiber blades. No plan survives first contact with the enemy.
"Ain't that the truth?" he whispered.
17. Normally, the underground laboratory on Peaks Island smelled strongly of antiseptic cleaning solutions and crisp, filtered air. But not today. Instead, the air had an almost tangy, gamey bite to it, and with Kate's full white bunny suit, it seemed as if Kate were running a full-scale butcher shop in a fabrication clean room. A surgical mask clung to her face and goggles pressed against her forehead. She leaned over a laboratory bench in the cell culture room. Beside her was Dr. Carr. The scientist hemmed and hawed as he peered over the acrylic cylinder nearly a foot in diameter lying between them. A mess of smaller tubes hung off the end of the clear cylinder, providing the nutrient-rich media that kept the tissues inside of it alive. To the untrained eye, the mass of red inside looked like chopped-up hamburger meat, which might have been horrifying to someone like Big Horn. But Kate found it fascinating.
"You think this bioreactor is enough to contain these tissues?" Carr asked, pointing to the acrylic tube.
"Nothing's escaped yet," Kate said. "And it's not like these tissues have a mind of their own. They grow extraordinarily fast, though. How long until they outgrow the bioreactor?"
Kate glanced at the window separating the cell culture room from the main portion of the lab. The handful of techs Carr had brought with him were working in there. Some peered through microscopes. Others pipetted samples into tubes for PCR or other quantitative analysis.
"The cells, as fast as they grow, still obey the basic laws of physics and nature," Kate said. "They only grow so long as we're feeding them. If I cut off their nutrient supply, they go dormant."
"Dormant?" Carr asked.
"Not just into a senescent state?" "From my observations, that's not the case with these things. It seems like there's nothing they like to do more than divide. And they're damned hard to kill."
"Strange. Almost as if they're cancerous."
Kate pressed a finger to the acrylic tube with the cells throbbing inside it. The acrylic was warm to the touch.
"All the phenotypic analysis I performed before you arrived confirmed my initial suspicions. These cells are a mix of white blood, nerve, and muscle cells."
"Did you test for any cancer markers?"
"No," Kate replied. "Didn't have the bandwidth by myself."
Carr's brow furrowed beneath his goggles. He seemed agitated. I suppose I can allocate one of our team members to look into it. I'd appreciate that. Knowing what kind of cells we're dealing with is great, but there's something else beyond cell phenotype that we need to figure out. I'm already one step ahead of you, Dr. Lovato. Carr wheeled over a cart from a corner of the cell culture room. He pulled back a blue sheet covering the top. This is from the autopsy, Carr said. He waved a hand over a long slice of tissue from a metal tray. The tissue had been isolated from one of the spindly growths jutting out of the alpha spine. Excellent, Kate said. So far, every cell culture that I've grown looks like this. She gestured to the mess within the bioreactor. Once I grow these cells on their own, even if it's a piece of intact webbing obtained from the field, they invariably grow into a blob of tissue with no organization. These tumorous monstrosities look nothing like nerve cells or the webbing, Carr said. I suspect it has something to do with a lack of external stimulus. That's what I was thinking. Kate rotated the bioreactor to get a view of the chunky tissue floating around within. Normally, the cells in our body depend on microenvironmental cues to direct cell behavior. The cells I've been growing in here have no directional cues. Yes. Yes, this is very basic biology. Carr picked up the tray with the alpha spindle and placed it next to the bioreactor. And that's all correct. I have the key to this dilemma right here. Carr held up a small box-shaped device with dials. A few wires stuck out of the sides attached to metal clips. My hope is to show you how we can induce the web-like growth you've seen with the external stimulus missing from your cell cultures, he said. And how is that? Kate asked. Carr began attaching the metal clips to the exposed nerves and the alpha spindle. An electric wire then went between another batch of nerves, and he handed the free end to Kate. Connect this to the webbing samples within your bioreactor, he instructed. It should stimulate an electrical signal. Kate wormed the wire into a valve and pushed it through the liquid media until it made contact with the tissue mass inside the bioreactor. She could have sworn the tissue recoiled at the touch. But that was impossible. This thing couldn't feel or react. Right? It was just a bunch of mindless cells. Is it embedded in the tissue? Carr asked. Kate jostled the wire. She was feeling more like an assistant than a full-blown scientist with Carr demanding these things of her. Cut the suspense and tell me what you're thinking, she said. Carr started to mess with the dials on the box. This here is a controller. I've attached electrodes to one end of the alpha spindle. I'm hoping to apply an electric stimulus to it. Now Kate could clearly see where he was going with this. Her eyes traced the spindle, then the wire that led into the bioreactor. You're going to stimulate a nerve response from the alpha into the tissue. Precisely. Carr smiled confidently. I believe that these alphas exude the electrical stimuli necessary to direct the proper hierarchical growths of the webbing. The spindles and growths jutting out of the alpha spine likely serve as antennae. Carr initialized the controller. It buzzed to life. From those antennae, I believe the alpha spreads a signal that tells the webbing to grow, using it to communicate with the variants around it, he said. How did you get all that from one autopsy? Kate asked, unable to contain her skepticism on this simple solution. If she had learned one thing from the variants, it was that the more you thought you knew about them, the less you actually did. Still, she hoped Carr was right. Figuring out how this webbing worked, and most importantly, what the variants were using it for, would greatly help Team Ghost and all the others stuck in the field with these monsters. If this works, we should see the tissue begin to pulse, just like reports indicate in the tunnels, Carr said. And after that, the tissue will begin to self-organize into web-like formations. Let's try it out. Carr turned the dial on the controller. The alpha spindle contracted. Clearly, the electrical signal was having some effect. The spindle soon began to shiver, and Carr had to grab hold of the tray to keep it from shaking the spindle off the lab bench and onto the floor. This is not exactly what I expected. The muscles within the thin spindle are reacting far more violently than one would anticipate. In fact, I wouldn't have thought, given the proper connections, we'd see any reaction at all based off the footage of the alpha. Kate monitored the cells within the bioreactor. They didn't seem to be doing anything yet.
Are you sure you have the wire connected properly? Carr asked.
Kate adjusted the wire to ensure it was embedded deep within the mass of tissue. She could feel the resistance as she tried to push it through the robust cells.
It's definitely in there good.
Kate bent to eye level with the bioreactor.
Wait, I see something.
What? Are they forming webbing already? Kate narrowed her eyes. The tissue was pulsing, but the cells weren't forming webbing. Instead, the tissue seemed to be bulging, almost like a flexing muscle.
It's not thinning out and forming a spiderweb, Kate said. In fact, it looks like it's doing the opposite.
Something isn't right. Likely the electrical stimulus. I'm turning it up.
No, Kate said.
I think... But it was too late. Carr had already turned the dial, increasing the voltage. The alpha spindle thrashed like a snake missing the head. It bucked out of the metal pan as electricity flowed through it and into the bioreactor. The tissue inside went wild. Sections ballooned and deflated, pressing against the clear acrylic walls containing it. Pieces of tissue spread out and jagged spikes pushing into the tubes feeding the cells liquid media. Kate turned off the pump, afraid adding pressure to the system would rupture it. But the tissue didn't seem to care. Part of it migrated into the tubes leading into the main bioreactor. The tubes popped off, unable to contain the intense pressure of the tissues pushing on the liquid. Pink cell media sprayed over the lab bench and floor. Fractures spread through the acrylic. Before Kate could do anything, the plastic split and the throbbing mass of red tissue expanded.
"Turn off the controller!" Kate yelled at Carr.
He didn't react in time. The tissue inside exploded, sending red globules throughout the space. The meaty hunks smacked against the walls and peppered the scientists. Frozen in place, Kate simply stared. Then she reached up to wipe off the chunks from her goggles and the front of her suit. Carr did the same thing, cursing.
"Next time, maybe you should be a little more cautious and listen to me," Kate said somewhat angrily.
If Carr had heard her, he didn't seem to react.
"Doctor?"
She turned to see bits of tissue dripping off him.
"I'm just trying to think of where I went wrong," he said quietly. "I think you had the right idea, but you can't rush science, you should know that."
A few of the lab techs were gawking at them beyond the window to the cell culture room. Carr waved them in and ordered them to start assisting the cleanup. Kate and Carr exited the room to exchange their lab garments for clean suits, goggles, and gloves while the techs worked. When Kate and Carr were changed, they re-entered the cell culture room.
"Instead of going big right away, we need to start small and work our way up," Kate suggested. "Something definitely happened with the electrical signal, and I want to figure out if we can control it."
Carr slid the controller over to her on the table.
"I'll let you drive this time."
Kate prepared smaller plastic plates full of tissue to scale down the experiment. This time, even if there was an accident, there wouldn't be much more than a tiny splash. She attached the spindle and the electrical wire to the small tissue samples. They slowly went through the samples.